Every weekday, on page 2 of the Inquirer's Metropolitan section, Clark DeLeon writes the scene column, highlighting unusual happenings around town. He's been writing the column for about the past 6 years. A native of Philadelphia, he grew up in Narberth. I invited him to Fresh Air to tell us about how he keeps tabs on what's happening in Philadelphia and how he puts together his column. Clark DeLeon, I enjoy your column, and it's a great treat to have you here in Fresh Air. Welcome.
Thank you, Terry.
How do you start to write the column?
I was hired at the Inquirer right out of Temple University in 1972. So I worked for 2 years doing a number of things. I was a general assignment reporter. I worked in Westchester. And at one point I was writing the Action Line column in the Inquirer. And during the course of writing that every day, I guess the editors noticed I had a certain flair for writing a column. And it was in 1974 when the Inquirer instituted its scene package. And if you're a reader of the Inquirer, you know that I don't have the only scene column. There's a scene column in the first section called the National Scene. Then there used to be a sports scene. And then there's a scene in Home and Finance. So there were four columns called the scene when I started writing the scene. And it was over the years that my column evolved into more of a personal expression, which is exactly what the editors didn't want, and they fought against it.
Why not?
Well, the concept of the column was that it be an institutional column that anyone could fill in and write this column called The Scene. And originally, it was a staff of four people. Four people you were just to turn out that one column. And when I took it over, I was rewarded for my good work by having the people taken away, and eventually I was doing it all by myself. But even for close to 2 years, I wrote the column without a byline. It was just a blank at the bottom. And since I was used to getting a byline as a reporter, I was constantly needling. I said, how about a byline? I think it's time. Everyone knows that there's a person writing this column. So eventually gave in and gave me a little sig, or rather by Clark DeLeon at the bottom of the column. And then 2 years ago, I was given the little picture you see on the column with all the little black dots, the artsy thing.
Well, what does it mean in the newspaper business to have a byline and to have a photo? What's the significance of each of those?
Well, it's the same as having your photo on radio. No one recognizes you. The photo I have in the Inquirer, in terms of recognition, if that's what you mean, no one can really recognize me from that. In terms of impact in the paper, I think people tend to look at bylined columns that have a little photo because they figure, well, this person's a columnist, so they'll read it. And its impact, it didn't change what I did every day at all when I got the photo. I would say a year later, when I looked back on that year after I'd had the photo, there was a difference. I mean, more people noticed the column and were recognizing my name. So name recognition improved.
What you were talking about, that approach to writing things like that, where a lot of people chip in and no one has their name on it, and it's not personal. I think like people pages tend to be like that in the what's happening amongst the stars type column, and even in the New Yorker and the around town column, everybody writes a piece and nobody signs it, and they're all very personal,
right?
But you never know who it was that was doing the traveling.
Well, it's funny you mentioned the New Yorker and the original. A hope of the scene column was that it would be something like the New Yorkers around town, or something like Newsweek's Intelligencer, and something like a lot of other things. So what it became was something like what Clark DeLeon would write if he were writing a column every day.
Now, I and many others read your column to see what's up, what's funny, what's happening. How would you describe to someone what you're trying to do in your column?
It's hard to say what I try to do every day. Basically, what I do when I come in the morning is hope that I'll have an interesting, entertaining, and amusing column. And three things there are working. Interesting is along the lines of, well, gee, I didn't know that, or, oh, I should go down there and see that. Entertaining may be skillfully written, which I think more than a lot of columnists who write an items column, which is what I do, maybe 5 items a day, I work on the writing end of it and try to make it a little more, not to over emphasize it, literary. I try to be a good writer rather than just throw it out. And then amusing, that's something I've developed over the years, is writing a funny column. I try to poke fun at things, whether it's politicians or things I notice on TV or the little things on the street. Well, this morning, for instance, that Christmas tree. Now, here's a Christmas tree 3 weeks before Halloween, and just rushing the season. And everyone can appreciate that.
Well, what happened? You were walking on Market Street and noticed the tree?
Well, that one came from one of my sources, as I say. Someone noticed that and knew that that would be a good picture or item in the scene column, so they gave me a call and alerted me to that.
Now, what do you do to keep in touch with your sources? Are there a series of phone calls or places that you'll go to every day to see what's happening?
Yeah, generally what I do is work the phones, because as much as it's romanticized, I guess, on TV, not so much on Lou Grant, I'll talk about that sometime, but on other shows, the reporter's always running around, or like a Quincy. Quincy will never pick up a phone when he can have the opportunity to jump in his car and drive 100 miles and ask the same question he could have gotten in 5 minutes. The phone is a wonderful instrument, and especially when you're dealing in words, you can get all this information by phone very quickly. So I work the phones a lot. I have people I call almost every day, or at least once a week, that I'll just check in and say, how's it going? Anything to report? And by now, I don't have to explain what I do. I just call up, say, what's happening? And they will or will not have something going. When I start cultivating a source, I will talk to them a little more, try to draw them out, have them see. A lot of people think a newspaper reporter, if you're talking to them, they want news. And of course, I'm not dealing so much in news as little maybe something happened in the office that has nothing to do with the functioning of that office, but would make an interesting anecdote. So what I do is just get people to forget that I'm there to get something and just tell me a story they might tell you to make you laugh. And when that happens, then I get items, and next thing you know, when something funny happens, they call me up to let me know. So it's an enjoyable column that way, because I'm usually dealing with things that make people laugh or that they want to have in the paper.
Everybody would like to be in your column, too, I think, because it's certainly a way of telling all of Philadelphia what you're doing, mm-hmm. or what you've done that's funny. What are some of the extremes people have gone to in the in their attempt to get their name or picture in your column?
It was funny. Just yesterday, a midget in a green Robin Hood costume came into the office with a press release. And it had something to do with Christmas. I haven't even, as a matter of fact, I was so amused by him, I didn't even read the press release. But that was an idea. That's an idea of what professional public relations people will try to get something like that. They'll have a clown come in, or they'll have somebody dressed up like a Cookie Monster, something like that, or send a telegram. As far as a reader, or just a person off the street, there aren't too many extremes like that you get, you find any payola or something. They say, here's some money if you'll get me in the column. I've never been solicited outright like that. As far as there are PR people who have tried, you know, who constantly will just invite you places. And I don't think they mean it to try to get to soften you up. It's just one of the tools they have of meeting the press. So, but I can't accept those invitations that often, simply because there's no reason for me to be going out to an expensive restaurant with a particular person just to get a free meal, you know?
Well, if I put on a funny-looking costume and ran over to your office as soon as you get back there with a press release, you think I'd make it into your column?
Well, see, once a gimmick's used, then I click off to it. I'm a sucker for a good gimmick. I think when they're funny and well-conceived, I'll go along with it. Eileen Reynolds over at the Franklin Institute was the first PR person in Philadelphia to send a city editor a singing telegram. And that was wonderful. It was hilarious. Got a big crowd in the city room when that happened a few years ago. But now it's become old hat, you know, and people trying it now. And after a while, the city editor can handle so much singing telegrams, or so many, and it's counterproductive, you know. I was trying to think of some other examples of what people had done to try to get in the column or in the paper. There's one old PR guy who I won't mention in town who's he's got a shtick, and his shtick is to send a cheesecake from the restaurant he represents to any famous person who is either in town or has been in town and is going away. So he will send a cheesecake to Australia or to California, and he's constantly doing this, and I keep telling him, that's not a story just because you're sending this around. But it's like an old device he used, and he has used it to this day. It might be 20 years old.
Is it ever hard for you to be in that position of having to say no to people?
It used to be. I think when I was early on, I wasn't sure what the proper etiquette was, because as a new, say, columnist, I wasn't sure what a column was supposed to be. So I would be a little less sure of myself. Now I feel very comfortable in saying, no, I can't use it, or no. Or I'll even get annoyed sometimes and say, come on, you know I don't use that. Why are you coming at me with that?
You know, when I started doing this show and another show like it, my one of my fears when people would call up who I would be turning down for an interview was that they had been maybe practicing doing this for like 24 hours, because I know what it's like to be timid about mm-hmm. making a certain kind of phone call. They finally had gotten up their strength and their courage, and they made that call, and I was like, nah, sorry.
Yeah.
That they'd be crushed and scarred for life. But I decided, no, that in 99.9% of the cases, a person was definitely going to live through it, that they weren't going to be
right.
crushed like that, and that you have to learn how to say no. And
you
when
can
the
be nice about
no.
it, but you know, it's the old assertiveness training. You know, you just know how to say no and let people understand that you don't hate them. You just can't use what they're trying to sell you.
But there's people who don't want to hear a no. How do you handle them?
I never hang up on people. I'll put them on hold a long time. I've never had anyone be so obnoxious that they just drove me. There are people who drive me crazy, but never so obnoxious that I give in and just write about them for that sake. There have been times in the past when there was a couple people. You know, there are local personalities who. Are the classic definitions of people who are famous merely for being famous. You know, that's their lot in life, is have their name well known. And those kind of people, as soon as a new column arrives in town, it's like blood and water, and the sharks start circling, and they see that as an outlet for them. So when I first started, I got a lot of that. A lot of the people, personalities around town who wanted to find the new access to the Inquirer, as it were. And I learned through that experience to know when to hold, know when to fold, that sort of thing. I just knew who I could get in the column and who I should keep out as a matter of principle.
Does it make a difference to you if you're approached by an individual representing themselves, calling on their own behalf, or by someone who's a publicist or an agent for an individual?
It all depends on the individual, how sincere they are, how good the idea is. Sometimes you get like a housewife will call, or a father of a child who they think is exceptional, and they want to let you know this. And I always listen to people. The professional PR person, the advantage they have, most of them, is that they know how to deal with newspaper people. They know how to present something in under 10 minutes, you know, where you get somebody who, as you say, gets nervous, they prepare it, and they get a little flustered. And I'll listen generally. I'm patient that way. I'll let somebody get it all out. But the PR person at least has it down pat how to present something.
Your regular readers are probably wondering, like I am, about some of the recurring stories that you've been following for some time. So let's talk about a couple of those. Now, the first that comes to my mind is the Al Perlman Mickey Mouse-eared poster.
The famous Apple.
Tell us how the whole thing started and how you've been following it.
Okay, that all started, I think, just a little more than a year ago, when I got an anonymous phone call from someone who identified themselves as a member of Apple. He didn't say what it was. And he said that there is going to be an Al Perlman poster on City Line Avenue. Something's going to happen to it. He didn't say what. And I didn't know what was. I figured that they were going to burn it or some, you know, throw ink on it or something. So the next day, the operatives from Apple, which stands for the Anti-Permanent Perlman Poster League of the East, they came up with some wonderful acronyms, by the way. Apple put a pair of Mickey Mouse ears with kind of an applique. It wasn't painted on. It was put on with, you know, the kind you peel back, a little sort of rubbery plastic thing that sticks. And they just added mouse ears and nose and a little bow tie like Mickey Mouse. And it was hilarious. It was the funniest thing I had seen in a long time.
Will they photograph it and send you a picture?
No, I sent a photographer out to find out what had happened. And at the same time, I ran the picture of Perlman in the column with the poster with the Mickey Mouse ears on it. And the Apple guy who identified himself as Macintosh, he called me to say that because I'd written an item saying that something was going to happen to an Al Perlman poster, he said that Apple would take measures against the media types who don't live up to their off-the-record statements or something like that. So I saw this as an opportunity of fooling around with, if I was going to tease Al Perlman, I thought I could tease myself. So in the column I said, well, that's an idle threat. Apple can't do anything to me. And it was my last line, is they can't do anything to me, or us, as I said. And my picture in the column, I had the art department add Mickey Mouse ears, a nose, and the bow tie. So that was the start of Apple. And the whole purpose of that was that Al Perlman had put up these posters that were literally permanent. They were high up on telephone poles made out of real hard fiber board, and he planned to have them up all during the primaries, all during the general election, and there are still Al Perlman posters up, so he was planning on leaving them up. So this group of people, I found out they have their headquarters in Germantown, they merely wanted to embarrass him into taking down the posters. So they came up with a number of different ways of defacing or improving the Al Perlman poster. They made him look like a gangster. They made him look like a clown. They made him look like somebody from outer space. Really kind of clever. And I had one with him thumbing his nose at people saying, I'll take it down when I'm good and ready. So that's been a recurring story.
Well, what kind of reaction have you gotten from Perlman?
It's funny. You know, I would call up and ask what they're going to do about the posters, and they would keep getting the secretary, and she would say, well, we're planning on taking them down. So I ran into him in city council one time, and I went over to introduce myself, make sure he knew who I was. And so he takes my hand. He's got a big fist, and he sort of bangs the top of my hand with his fist. So you're Clark DeLeon, eh? He says, are you sure you're not Apple? And I assured him that I wasn't. And he was very pleasant, not at all. He said, you won't believe how many people come up and ask me about that. Because he likes it, I think. It's in a reverse way, I've created a monster in that it's made Perlman even more famous. You know, every day who is this Al Perlman guy? So he enjoys it.
Yeah, you know, a lot of people feel that bad publicity is as useful as good
absolutely,
publicity.
Absolutely, absolutely. But at the same time, you know, being in a position as one who would provide publicity, I have to figure, well, here's the bad publicity. If that's what happens, even bad publicity makes the person more famous and they like it. Well, I'm sorry, but I still got to give them I have to give this negative news.
This week has seen the continuation of another running story or running relationship that you're having in your column, and this time with Michael Picozzi, the morning DJ on WMMR.
Right.
Now, how did that whole thing between the two of you start?
That was a funny one. I had attended a function where WMMR was doing a live broadcast one morning, and I just wanted to see what it was like. So Picozzi was doing the show from the stage at the Bijou. And I was in the audience, and he sent word out that wanted to come up and say a few words on the air. And I just didn't figure, I'm there as a reporter, I didn't want to go up and do a show. So after that, he began to do a thing in the mornings where he would say, well, I offered Clark DeLeon a chance to come up and say a few words on radio. I think he ought to give me a paragraph in his column. So he started hectoring me over the air, give me a paragraph. So finally he calls me one morning. He has this thing where he wakes up people on the show. He calls me at home and wakes me up, and he surprised me by that. And but I agreed. I thought it was pretty funny. You know, this is a unique way of going about it. So he agreed. He wrote a paragraph, which I published. And at the end of his paragraph, I said, well, if you have the courage to appear in a newspaper, I have the courage to go on radio and sing a song. So that's what I did the following week.
I didn't get to hear that. What did you sing?
I sang Sloop John B, which is the Beach Boys version. I had the Beach Boys assisting me in the background. And everyone told me it sounded real good, so I was pleased. Then last week, I played in this celebrity softball game at the Vet before the Cubs game. And I was playing left field and made a miserable play. I just misplayed a foul ball, as Lonnie Smith or Gary Maddox can tell you, happens every now and then. But I looked very silly doing it, and I let in three runs. It was a three-run homer because it just went over my head and rolled to the fence. So the next day, he teased me mercilessly on the air about that, because he was playing in the other team. So he credited me for the score, which was a tie, and he thanked me for letting all three of their runs in. And so the next morning, I woke up, and he was still teasing me. So I called him up to say, hey, come on, what do I have to do to get out of this? You know, don't embarrass me continually. So this time, he said, well, I wrote a paragraph last time. And I said, okay, how about doing it? I already knew in advance that it was going to be fun. I would play around with it. I said, why don't you draw something? So he drew a character from his childhood, which is called a Fenorton, which was looked like a creature from outer space that juggles chocolate chip cookies. Very silly. So this runs in the column. And this morning, as a payback, I had the members of the White Marsh Rugby Club, which I play for. We went down there and we sang some rugby songs, which aren't the type you'd generally find being sung over the airwaves. But we had a good time. And that was just a little silliness, which I think is fun every now and then in a newspaper.
All blackmail should be as pleasant as this.
Yeah, exactly. It wasn't really blackmail as much as we mutually agreed it would be fun to do something like that.
What are some of your favorite running stories or one-time stories?
A couple years ago, there was a guy. This was when I got a phone call out of nowhere. It's a guy from South Carolina. He's coming up to Philadelphia for the bicentennial. What he's doing, he was pushing a watermelon from South Carolina to Philadelphia in honor of the bicentennial, and he was doing it to draw attention to the plight of black farmers in the South. But this, think of it, you know, here's a guy pushing a watermelon from South Carolina to Philadelphia. So I dubbed him the Great American Watermelon Roller Man, and we followed his progress as he came up. Up from the South, and he eventually ended up he became a mini celebrity because of what I was writing about him, and he ended up presenting rolling his watermelon into Franklin Field before an Adams soccer game, and there was a big halftime ceremony where he was given something, and it was just kind of another little silly story that you wouldn't ordinarily find, especially one that you would keep a track of it.
So if that was me, I'd worry that I'd meet this guy with the watermelon when he came to town, and he turned out to be a psychotic.
No. I had spoken to him, so I got the feeling he was sincere. You know, you go by hunches a lot. Is this just another nut, or is it somebody who thinks this is one way of really attracting attention?
Did that ever happen to you, that you thought someone was going to be, like, really neat and have something to say, or they turned it out to be just really loony?
Yeah. And then it's one of those, you're sort of backing your way toward the door, just hoping that you get out without any unpleasantness.
What are some of the things that have gotten the biggest response for you?
It's funny, you know, anytime I put anything in the paper with a phone number, like what I think is just a little throwaway thing, maybe for the Franklin Institute or the Committee of 70, every year they come to me, they have this voter guide to put out, and they say, and they ask me to put in the phone number, they give these things away for free, and they get hundreds and hundreds of calls, and that's when I realize sort of the impact of the column is when they tell me later, the switchboard was jammed all day long, and I know it's only that one little item in the scene column that did it. As far as impact on items, stories that I've done, I don't know if I've changed anything, and you know, no government official or I do things like I can get the fountains turned on at Logan School Circle or something like that. I'll notice that how come the fountains aren't on, and then I'll write an item about it. Next day the fountains are on, and I kind of like that, where I provide a public service in that a lot of people wonder about that, but I have the vehicle to put my frustration in print, and so little things like that. I have an effect on the inner workings of some organizations, let's say TV stations, or I wouldn't call it industry gossip, but I guess some people would, just what's going on backstage kind of things. And that apparently has a great effect within the organizations that I report on.
Well, I remember you picking up, and I can't remember exactly what it was. Oh, I remember. You've picked up on a couple of technical mistakes at TV and mm-hmm. radio stations, and recently picked up on KYW All News Radio was doing like a greatest hits of KYW, and you tell the story.
Well, it's funny. You think it's me, but it started out as a scene item and ended up as a regular story. That was when
I read that in your column.
The Three Mile Island alert.
That's right, yeah.
Yeah, the... KYW did the original alert from Three Mile Island, which included their signature beep, 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 which is alerts everybody to that a big story is breaking. So newsrooms around the city have KYW on just to sort of monitor it. And when this beep, beep, beep came on, everyone's ears perked up. What they hadn't heard was them explaining that this is a repeat of what happened a year ago. So all they heard was that state police have alerted of a nuclear accident at Three Mile Island. And everybody went into a frenzy immediately. And KYW started apologizing virtually the next minute, but it was too late. I mean, Three Mile Island, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, newspapers were getting calls. And it was funny because an almost identical thing happened in the midst of Three Mile Island when there was an ABC or one of the new networks had a news brief, which was a rerun of a news brief from 2 weeks earlier. Somehow I think the show was delayed or something, and ended up that this the meltdown, the story when the hydrogen gas bubble was forming and it was really scary, well, that story came up 2 weeks after the fact and everything had been calmed down, and immediately everyone got frightened again, and it was crazy. I don't know how that stuff happens.
Are there any other technical errors or... errors like that?
I'll listen to things like one time KYW reported that the Schuylkill River is as of 8 o'clock, the Schuylkill River is flowing downstream, and they were talking about a flood, but the way it came out, just an obvious, no kidding. And television's a riot for some of the local news programs. I always watch them to see what I can pick up. Jim O'Brien on Channel 6 is hilarious, and I don't write about him nearly as much as I could, because almost every night he says something outrageous that would make a nice item. This guy Wayne Shannon on Channel 3 I've written about. He's like a Bill Curry, one step more. He's a consumer Bill Curry with his own style, and I didn't particularly like his act. He's one of these guys, I guess, that grows on you. He hasn't really grown on me yet, but KYW thought that he would be an answer to something. And you heard that the general manager at KYW is leaving, which is, that's really something. Here's a guy who brought all these people in and had everybody really lined up in support of him. He is a very dynamic person, had a lot of leadership ability. Now he's leaving. Now I really wonder what's going to happen to that station.
Yeah, I was wondering that.
So these are kind of running stories. I keep my eyes on things and try to stay on top of what is changing in Philadelphia, in the media, in government, so forth.
One thing that you've picked up on in the local media is the fact that Ira Einhorn is the book editor now for mm-hmm. Electric City.
Right.
Tell us about some of the things that you've pointed out from there.
Well,
you might give some of the background about him for our listeners.
Well, Ira Einhorn is... for years was known in Philadelphia as the he was the full-time hippie around town, the guru, he was called. During the 60s, he was a guy who organized be-ins and various events, kind of far-out things. But he was very accessible to the media, and he was always good for a quote, and the media knew if you needed some guy with long hair and who had his was involved with the left and with various psychological experimental groups, he would always be able to help you out. So Ira had been sort of not in the media so much of late. He wasn't running for mayor as he did in the early 70s, but he's been accused of murdering his girlfriend, keeping her in the trunk in his apartment for over a year. And it's one of these things where when the body was discovered, he said, and we're like, well, how did that get there? I mean, it was such a, how do you explain that you've had a body in your living room for over a year? And so he's been out on bail now. It's been well over a year, maybe a year and a half. And so he had not been in the paper too much. Everyone was wondering, well, whatever happened to Ira? And he turned up as the book editor for Electric City, the new entertainment paper in town. And when I called up the editor, I said, well, how come, what happened? What's with Ira being your book editor? And she said, tongue-in-cheek, the editor, well, we were in a tough situation and Ira bailed me out, which I put in the column. And it was obviously a reference to his situation in jail. And I've written a couple of things just on the books he's reviewed. He's chosen some interesting ones, like the most recent one he has a reviewer copy of is a book on how to beat a lie detector, and or the uses and the abuses of the lie detector, A Tremor in the Blood, I think is the title of the book. But again, it was just kind of that would make a scene item. Just the fact that you point out the irony or the coincidence and let people draw what they can from it.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Clark DeLeon, who writes the scene column in the second page of the Metropolitan section of The Enquirer every weekday, and we're talking about how he puts it together and what kinds of things he covers in it. Now, you live in Queen Village now, right?
Mm-hmm,
and
right.
You grew up in Narberth, which is
right.
Right outside of Philadelphia. When you go, I know you were recently on a rugby tour and toured some countries in Europe, and when you're in another country, if you speak with people from there, they ask you about where you're from and
mm-hmm.
what you like about it. Now, since you are extremely acquainted with Philadelphia
right.
from having been here all your life and then having written about it and covered it in depth,
mm-hmm.
what do you tell people halfway around the globe who say, well, what's Philadelphia like?
Well, usually I start out with, it's near New York. No, it's funny. People are aware of Philadelphia. They know that it's an old city on the East Coast that was where the Declaration of Independence was signed. And basically, as many Americans could tell you, that's where their knowledge of Philadelphia ends. But I'm very excited about Philadelphia. When I go overseas, I always take a lot of photographs and brochures and things about the city, and they always ooh and ah when they see it because they just have no idea what the city looks like. And my feeling on Philadelphia is it's a beautiful, gracious city that has, for some reason, and I guess you have to blame the people who've been running the city all these years, has gotten a bad rap somehow in the national or international image, whether it was the W.C. Fields thing or not. But I also think in these years that I've been writing, I've noticed the positive reaction coming from outside the city toward Philadelphia. Like, Philadelphia is what you might call a hot city right now. A lot of people are perking up and paying attention to Philadelphia. There are a number of things contributing to that. Rizzo was one. I mean, he just made people look at Philadelphia, made people come to Philadelphia to cover things. The other thing is the downtown, the development in Center City. It's beautiful. And the nightlife, the renaissance of restaurants, the blossoming of culture, whether it's the Pennsylvania Ballet, which has become a first-rate cultural institution, and a positive attitude on the part of a lot of Philadelphians, such as myself, and I would include myself in that category. I don't apologize at all for Philadelphia, and I am quite proud of the city.
Mm-hmm.
And I just think that in the 80s, Philadelphia will emerge more and more as a city, let's say a tourist center. I think people are going to, you'll find more people from New York. Let's take a weekend in Philadelphia and see, and look around. I know a lot of people in New York who really love Philadelphia because it's a big city, but it's not New York, and which is so huge. Philadelphia is it's almost quaint when you think of it, that it's such a large city with such a controllable downtown area. You can walk it every which way. So I think Philadelphia's in for some good times, and I'm really a booster that way. I'm a shameless.
I understand that there's a bit of a newspaper war now, I guess, between the Bulletin and the Inquirer, the Bulletin being under...
Well, I would say there was a newspaper war. I would say the war is over and the Inquirer has won. The Bulletin right now is in deep trouble, as the Bulletin's admitted in print. The financial situation of that paper is very shaky. The new management has just split in half, more or less, where Carl Eller, who is a publisher, was with Charter Oil, and they had formed a group, Charter Media. Now Charter Media has more or less pulled out of the Bulletin, and it's just Carl Eller who controls it, because there was a question of how can a newspaper be owned by an oil company? A lot of people were hesitant. And a lot of people in the industry are afraid of what the consequences of oil companies buying up media properties. And apparently that had prevented them from acquiring more properties. So I think that was one reason behind the split. And the editors of the Bulletin have said that if the paper doesn't turn around within a year, they may have to go into an agency agreement. And an agency agreement is a situation where because so many papers have had to fold in the past, they will more or less merge with another paper to do joint printing and share the costs of delivery and things like that. So what that would mean would be that the Bulletin would be published by the Inquirer. It would still be the Bulletin and still have its independence, but it would be more or less under the wing of the Inquirer. And if that ever happened, it would just... changed dramatically the situation in Philadelphia of newspapers. The Bulletin, for as long as I've been in town, I mean, my entire life, was the dominant paper in Philadelphia. For the first time ever, or in years, the Inquirer now surpasses the Bulletin circulation. You notice the Bulletin doesn't have those ads, we're number one, the Bulletin's number one, because it's not true anymore. So, what we have now in Philadelphia is a very unique situation. It's the only city in the country with four daily newspapers. And it's possible that it could very soon have two daily newspapers. Because if the Bulletin were to go into agency with the Inquirer, there's a possibility the Daily News would, as a deal, let's say the Bulletin would give up its Sunday paper, and the Knight Ritter were... Philadelphia newspapers, which owns the Daily News, would fold the Daily News to allow the Bulletin no competition in the afternoon. That's one of the scenarios that, I mean, everyone's talking about that. And then we don't know how long the Journal will be around, Philadelphia Journal, which is primarily a sports paper. If the Philadelphia sports teams go into a nosedive, that could affect their circulation greatly. For right now, all the teams are winners. It's kind of interesting. I mean, a lot of people are paying attention to what's happening in Philadelphia with newspapers.
As a newspaper writer, does it make a difference to you if you're on the number one paper or the number two paper?
Number one in prestige, I think. Like, I like the Inquirer a lot. I mean, I like the people I work with. I like the philosophy of the paper, where it's going. It has its... I won't call them shortcomings. I'll call them things I would maybe do differently. But the paper is an excellent newspaper. I've seen it become an excellent newspaper from a fairly mediocre paper when I joined it 8 years ago. So I'm excited by that. I mean, the Inquirer's rise as a well-respected paper in the country has coincided with my own career, as I started out as your cub reporter, and now I'm doing a column. So I see that. I see I've been a part of that, and I enjoy that. I would not wanted to have been on the Bulletin when it was number one in circulation. It just, because it wasn't the kind of paper that the Bulletin wouldn't have known what to do with me, basically. You know, they wouldn't have known what to do with the Scene column. But the Inquirer had enough sense to let it develop the way it did.
Well, Clark, I wish you continued success. I enjoy reading your column.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot for telling us about it and about yourself and how you put your column together.
Sure.
I've been speaking with Clark DeLeon, who writes the Scene column, and that's on page 2 of the Metropolitan section of the Inquirer from Monday through Friday. And Clark, thanks again for being here.
Thanks, Terry.